number one in the nation for veteran population per capita. And yet we're the only state in the union without a veterans museum.
Seeking a permanent home for an Alaska Vets Museum. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, graduating from the Anchorage Police Citizens Academy.
Flame shot out of it, and it had a halo scope, and there's no way you could miss. I'm 74 years old, and I did 3 kill shots.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by NEA Alaska, promoting excellence in public education for Alaskan children through investment in education professionals. Online at neaalaska.org.
Joe Miller will continue his fight against the State Division of Elections in federal court. In an email released late last night, Miller said he won't oppose certification of the U.S. Senate race, but will file a motion in federal court today to stay the post-certification election contest timeline until after the federal case has concluded. Miller's attorneys asked U.S. District Judge Ralph Beislein to extend the post-certification deadline for seeking a recount or election contest until Beislein rules on the merits of his case and all appeals have been exhausted. Miller's federal suit was filed last month but required a final determination by the Alaska State Court to proceed further. A federal judge ordered a stay on the election certification until state court decided on Miller's complaint. A state superior court ruled against Miller's complaints against the State Division of Elections, and the Alaska Supreme Court upheld the superior court's decision. Miller said in a press release that after careful consideration and seeking the counsel of people he trusted, he had decided that the federal case must go forward. He said, "The integrity of the election is vital, and ultimately the rule of law must be our standard." Miller stated that he is withdrawing his opposition to the certification of the Alaska U.S. Senate election, pending a federal judge's removal of a stay against state certification that would allow Lisa Murkowski to be seated when Congress convenes in January. In court filings, Miller's legal team pointed out several issues that they say need further review. They include whether the U.S. Constitution's Election Clause and Equal Protection Clause were violated. Miller is also pressing his contention that felons cast votes in the November election. The state has until Wednesday to respond to Miller's charges. More than one-third of Alaska children do not have all the vaccines they need to fully protect them against preventable diseases. Public health providers want to know why. According to the National Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Alaska ranks 46th out of the 50 states for completing infant to early childhood immunization for everything from diphtheria to measles, mumps, and whooping cough. The CDC regularly conducts random telephone surveys of households with young children and the children's health care providers. The State Public Health Division is following up with a statewide survey of parents to determine why their children haven't been completely immunized. Mary Custer is the maternal child health consultant for the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The survey has 3 subscales. It looks at access to shots, concerns about shots, and importance of shots. So if we can find out a little bit more about what are the main barriers and what questions in each of the subscales scored the highest, then we'll be able to develop some strategies to try to address those barriers.
Custer says this is the first survey the state has done to find out just what parents know about vaccines and if they're worried about vaccine safety, don't believe in vaccines, or have trouble getting their children to a clinic. While the survey is anonymous, respondents are asked where they live so public health can target solutions to individual communities. Custer says anyone with children under 6 years old should take the SHOTS survey. It's online, and you can find a link to it at our website, APRN.org. The survey is also available at local public health clinics in rural communities. It can be found online and at local public health clinics in Village, Alaska. The Alaska Veterans Museum is in the process of seeking permanent housing. Retired Air Force Colonel Sue Ellen Wright Novak, currently president of the Alaska Veterans Museum, says the idea is catching on, but slowly.
Well, there's over 77,000 veterans in Alaska. We are number one in the nation for veteran population per capita. And yet we're the only state in the union without a veterans museum.
Novak says the museum has been active for a decade.
The idea was brought up here from Chehalis, Washington. Well, that idea caught on, and slowly but surely things took place. You know, there's a lot of paperwork that has to be put into place first. The museum has three missions. The first is to create a museum. The second is to educate the public on persons, operations, and sacrifices made by telling individual service member stories. And then the third thing that we do is we support the active duty, the guard, the reserve, the veterans, and the retirees. And we've been extremely active in all three areas.
Novak says educating the public is a top priority.
For educating the public, we've placed displays in all of the existing museums around here, and we're taking one in February down to the Commemorative Air Force's Air Power Heritage Museum down in Midland, Texas. That will be on the Aleutian campaign because it fills in a hole that they have. They talk about the Pacific Theater, and they never mention the Aleutian campaign. We've also got displays in local libraries, and that'll be a traveling one that we move from library to library.
Supporting the troops includes sending fan mail to servicemen and women overseas. The museum and its member organizations have sent around 69,000 cards so far, making them number one in the nation in that effort. The Veterans Museum is currently engaged in helping the members of the deployed 109th Transportation Company from Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson decorate their day room at Bagram Air Base. Donations of Alaska-themed items like T-shirts or caps with Alaska logos or Eskimo yo-yos, posters of Alaska scenes, would be welcome.
We're looking to ship some good-sized boxes over there.
The items can be dropped off at VFW posts in Eagle River. Alaska is second only to Oklahoma in the use of a U.S. housing and urban development program designed to increase home ownership among Alaska Native and American Indian people. Studies show a significant gap between Alaska Native and non-Native rates of home ownership. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
David Fote is the Alaska coordinator for the Section 184 Indian Home Loan Guarantee Program in the Alaska Head Office of Native American Programs. He says the 184 program can save buyers thousands of dollars through two main advantages.
Number one, a lower down payment requirement, and that is 2.25%. So that means that the borrower must invest $2,250 into the property for each $100,000 that they need to borrow. The other advantage is it has the lowest cost loan guarantee fee of any program available in the market. And that cost is a one-time cost of 1%.
With that low interest loan guarantee in place, Vogt says the buyer doesn't have to pay a monthly mortgage insurance fee. He says the program is a great success in Alaska.
In the federal fiscal year that just ended this past September, we had almost $75 million worth of loans in the 1 year in Alaska.
HUD has issued 1,400 loan guarantees to Alaskan tribal members compared to about 5,000 in Oklahoma. I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, snowshoeing under a full moon.
I love it up here, and it's just magical both in the summer and in the wintertime.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. It's almost time to file online for your PFD, and when you do, you can make an impact by sharing just a little with a cause you care about. Celebrate the arts, invest in education, shelter a homeless pet, lend a hand, or even make a wish come true when you pick, click, give to one of Alaska's nonprofits. Visit pickclickgive.org to decide how you will make Alaska better with a small gift from your PFD. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The next Officer Academy for the Anchorage Police Department won't take place until autumn of 2011 at the earliest. But this month, APD's Auxiliary Alumni Association honored another batch of Citizen Academy graduates. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The Auxiliary's Jim Kalitka oversees the now 13-session, mostly one-night-a-week academy. He was a member of the first Citizens Academy group in 2005, joined the Alumni Association immediately afterwards, and has been involved in all 11 since then. Over those years, the Anchorage Academy has become recognized by other police departments as one of the best in the nation.
Our instructors are actually instructors who teach in a regular police academy when they're in session. So we get what may be a week's course in a regular academy would be, we get a 45-minute version of it. So they cram a lot in a little bit of time.
45 minutes is the scheduled amount of time. Most sessions and evenings run longer. That's partially because the 24 or so citizens who take the free academy already have some interest in their community's police department. And their interests are as varied as the broad range of class topics. Those include recruitment, the use of force, traffic and DUI investigations, gangs, financial crimes, child abuse, sexual assaults, domestic violence, canine officers, SWAT teams. And as Kalitka notes, it's not all passive and can be disturbing.
The crime scene investigation, where they do the mock crime scenes, and that's the more eye-opening, aha type of, and in cybercrime, when they see what's really going on over the internet, and the predators are just looking for young children, young adults to take advantage of.
The second academy of 2010 began in mid-September, and except for post-graduation ride-alongs, ended with December's ceremony. Mary Jones was the oldest graduate. Her favorite session was the final one at the training center's indoor firing range.
They didn't tell me what I was shooting, but it was this great big gun with all these attachments and flames shot out of it, and it had a halo scope, and there's no way you could miss. I'm 74 years old, and I did 3 kill shots.
Sergeant Ted Smith, who taught the firearm safety class, knows which guns Jones enjoyed.
Well, with me, she shot 2 different Remington 870 shotguns, a 14-inch barrel one and a 9-inch barrel one. Then with one of my former SWAT sergeants, she shot an MP5 submachine gun. People love to shoot that gun.
At the opposite end of the age spectrum was Tyler Ososki. His favorite was the K-9 class.
The officers that were actually the K-9 handlers seemed like they had the most passion for their job. Seemed like they were the most trained, most well-experienced. They seemed like they knew their specialization the most.
Serena Warner had other choices.
Oh boy, I liked the homicide investigating, and I liked the shooting, of course. And I was very surprised at the chaplaincy and that they were all volunteers, but they staffed a full 24/7 calendar. I thought that was pretty amazing.
Beyond attracting recruits like Tyler, Police Chief Mark Mew says the department also hopes to lure some graduates into the police auxiliary. The auxiliary assists the police in large outdoor community functions, plus other crucial tasks like search teams.
There may be 28 officers out on the street on a given night. Maybe 4 or 5 of them can be involved in that search. So the search team comes out and basically they kind of take over the call. They do all the ground searching. They do all the door-to-door canvassing. They have electronic tracking devices for Alzheimer's patients. And they work for hours, all night long during the cold. We've used them for evidence searches as well. We're looking for a weapon or something like that that we believe has been stashed someplace.
If the attendees differ on favorite classes, like Warner, they agree on the academy itself.
It's a great class. My husband's thinking about taking it.
According to Kalitka, even before posting the dates on the Auxiliary Alumni Association's website, the next class is already attracting applicants. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Assembly members for the Matanuska-Susitna Borough met with state lawmakers last week to highlight priority projects for the borough for the coming year. The extension of a rail link from Port McKenzie to the main line is uppermost on the valley's wish list. The state is willing to put up $20 million for the project, but Matsu officials want an additional $35 million to start the first phase of the project. Borough estimates indicate another $107 million will be needed to finish the rail link by 2014. Next on the list, a ferry terminal at Port McKenzie for the new ice-breaking ferry MV Susitna. The estimated cost of the terminal is set at $12 million. Other projects desired by the valley include transportation upgrades for local traffic arteries, among them an access road for the South Denali Visitors Center. The borough also wants state funding for a Hatcher Pass ski trails project. Most Alaska black cod fishermen will see a higher allocation next year. The North Pacific Fishery Management Council recently approved staff recommendations to increase the allowable catch by 5% statewide. Black cod, also called sablefish, are mostly sold to Asia, though domestic markets are increasing. Southeast numbers will jump 14% and quotas in the West Yakutat area will go up 24%. Other increases are 5% in the Central Gulf and 2% in the Bering Sea. The Western Gulf will drop 2% and the Aleutians 8%. Diana Stram is plan coordinator for the Fishery Management Council in Anchorage.
For this stock in particular, there is an annual assessment, and what happens is that the assessment itself is reviewed by a stock assessment plan team. The plan team then makes recommendations that in this case often are exactly in line with the stock assessment author's recommendations in terms of an overfishing limit and an acceptable biological catch limit.
The recommendations are then reviewed and acted on by the council. The increase allows a 16,000-ton or 35-million-pound harvest in Alaska waters. About 835 people have permits to harvest Alaska sablefish. Around half of them are in Southeast. Numbers are expected to drop in 2012.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The state of Alaska is seeking reconsideration of a lawsuit decision over a new state law requiring that parents be notified before a girl younger than 18 can get an abortion. A judge rejected a request by Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest to block the law approved by voters last August. However, Superior Court Judge John Suddick removed provisions calling for a fine of up to $1,000 and imprisonment of up to 5 years for violators of the law. He also struck a section allowing physicians to be liable for damages. The state filed a motion to reconsider. Governor Sean Parnell said in a statement he would continue to work to ensure that Alaska's families are represented and that the law truly reflects the will of the people. Many Alaskans facing these darkest days of winter turn to vitamin D for help with depression and a myriad of other health issues. A recent international report shed some light on the pros and cons of a nutrient often used by those lacking exposure to light. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld takes a look at what we should know about the new research.
Type vitamin D into any online search engine and you'll get a long list of ailments it's supposed to help cure. Weak bones, bad balance, depression, certain types of cancer, the list goes on. The Institute of Medicine, an independent nonprofit organization, recently reviewed research on the vitamin as well as calcium at the request of the U.S. and Canadian governments. The Washington, D.C.-based group then issued a report summarizing what it found and recommending new dosages. That caught the attention of many in Alaska because sun stimulates the skin to make vitamin D. Leslie Shallcross is a registered dietitian and president of her profession's statewide organization.
We all have been concerned about vitamin D and getting adequate vitamin D in Alaska because we know that since we are so much farther north than the rest of the United States, that we may not get the benefit of adequate sun exposure.
Shellcross, who works for the Cooperative Extension Services Health, Home, and Family Development Program, says the study concluded the vitamin contributes to bone health. It increased the recommended daily dose for most people from 400 to 600 IUs, that's short for international units. But it didn't go as far as many hoped.
Certainly in Alaska, people experience winter depression. There's significant research showing low levels of vitamin D correlate with depression.
In fact, many Alaska doctors and other health professionals have been recommending increased dosages to help with the ailment. In Juneau, for example, doctors several years ago went to retailers and asked that they start selling vitamin D supplements. Shellcross says it's unfortunate the study didn't make that connection, but she says it's a good thing that it acknowledged vitamin D levels should increase.
I recommend that people have their level checked, and if their blood level of vitamin D is insufficient, if it's very low, they should follow their medical provider's recommendation to improve their vitamin D level.
She says Alaskans with low amounts in their blood will need more than the recommended minimums to catch up. The flip side of the Institute of Medicine study is research showing too much vitamin D can be a bad thing.
They did caution in the reports that there are potential risks for taking high doses of vitamin D.
Lisa Sadler-Hart is employee wellness coordinator for the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium in Sitka. She's followed the study and wants to make sure people know that more than 4,000 IU a day can cause problems, and too much calcium can also be bad.
Specific issues that can come up are things like kidney stones that can be problematic, as well as tissue damage. So to me, it's not probably something I'd want to risk.
Sadler-Hart says Americans tend to focus too much on one vitamin or nutrient rather than taking a holistic view. Before popping pills, she recommends looking at your diet.
I would say one of the very best sources of vitamin D for us in Alaska is salmon. And so we want to remember that and also remember that a lot of other foods are fortified with vitamin D, things like milk and other dairy products.
The Institute of Medicine report disappointed many who hoped for conclusive proof that the vitamin was a factor in a variety of problems beyond bone health. But Sadler-Hart says it might eventually lead to more answers.
What it's done is probably opened a box of potential future research that really needs to be done in order to answer some of these questions, especially the cancer questions and depression questions.
The report also increased the recommended calcium dosage. It went up from 800 to 1,000 milligrams for some age groups and from 1,000 to 1,300 for others. Safe maximums range from 2,000 to 3,000 milligrams per day. More details are online. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Homer residents looking for a social yet peaceful way to get outdoors and enjoy the winter solstice found what they were looking for at the Wynn Nature Center outside of Homer. KBBI's Aaron Selbig tagged along for a moonlight snowshoe walk during last week's full moon and has this story.
The Carl E. Wynn Nature Center has been holding a winter open house for the last 4 years, says director Beth Trowbridge, but this is the first year they decided to hold it on the evening of winter solstice.
Yeah, well, we were doing a bonfire, and we Lisa Matlock with the Fish and Wildlife Service has been coming up with her telescope to help us do some astronomy and look at the moon. And we love to get people out on snowshoes at night because it's not something that people typically do, and sometimes they're afraid to do it or whatever. And so this is kind of a neat experience. So that's kind of a big thing that we try to get people to do when they come up here at night is to do that. And then, of course, the cabin's warm and, you know, it's a kind of a cozy place to be.
Tucked away off East Skyline Drive in a patch of fireweed meadows and spruce forest, the Wynn Nature Center is a popular summertime destination, a place where kids and adults learn about the wilderness and the history of the old homestead, courtesy of the Alaska Center for Coastal Studies, which operates it. On this shortest night of the year, it's a great place to go snowshoeing.
I do have extra poles if anybody wants poles.
I do want
as some folks socialize inside, enjoying a potluck dinner and a cozy wood stove fire. A dozen or so kids and grown-ups strap on their snowshoes outside. After the last strap is strapped, we're off. Trowbridge is the resident expert on the flora and fauna of the old homestead, and along our walk, she proves to be an expert on many things, including snowshoe hares.
So they always look funny because they look like they have the front, you know, big feet are their front feet, but really their big feet are their back feet.
And moose.
We'll see moose up here until the snow gets, you know, maybe 3 or 4 feet deep, and then it's just too hard. You know, they're too hard to walk for food. And they'll head down, you know, into Homer more.
And squirrels.
And so they'll sit up in these trees up here on a little perch, and they'll take their spruce cones and just like, you know, corn on the cob, they'll, you know, eat it.
Our destination is the Elliott Fisher platform, a huge wooden gazebo-like structure that overlooks a vast meadow.
So wander around, stomp through the meadow. Yeah, stomp through the meadow. Try out your snowshoes where it's not so easy to walk.
Trowbridge tells us the meadow used to be a potato patch back when the homesteaders on the Homer Bench, like the Bellamy family who originally owned this property, grew much of their own food and seldom made it to town in the wintertime. The moon is so bright on the meadow, headlamps or flashlights are really unnecessary. Still, a handful of constellations are visible, as are the Kenai Mountains across Ketchumak Bay, their glaciers illuminated by the brilliant moonlight. Back at the center, Lisa Matlock has set up a telescope.
You can't touch the tripod. If you touch it, the blue moon will no longer be in it. So you just have to kind of, like, the best thing that I do is put my hands by my back.
Matlock works for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She brought her telescope to the Nature Center so people could get a close-up view of the nearly full moon.
This one is best with the moon. It's actually not really powerful enough to see a lot in terms of nebula or galaxies or things like that, but it's great for the moon, and it's only like $100. Telescope. It's a great starter telescope. It's a reflecting telescope. So they were a little confused before. Instead of looking straight through to the moon, you're looking at the moon's light that has bounced off a mirror that's in the back of it, and then the light has come back up to where they're looking at it through that eyepiece.
Matlock says her telescope was perfect for viewing Monday night's lunar eclipse. Although it's well known in Homer for its summertime educational activities, the Wind Nature Center still has plenty going on throughout the winter, says Trowbridge, including snowshoe walks every Wednesday from noon to 1 and family-friendly bonfires every first Sunday of the month at 2 p.m. Trowbridge says she spends a lot of her time on the grounds of the Nature Center, but she never tires of it.
I love it up here, and it's just magical both in the summer and in the wintertime. So you're close to town, but you feel like you're just far away from, you know, everywhere, and never tire of the Wind Nature Center. My favorite spot.
In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer, Jacqueline Estes, and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Rosemary Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, providing insight on statewide business and government issues. There's more information online at akbizmag.com.
Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.